We're going to call to order the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. Today is Wednesday, March 12th, 2014. We don't yet have a quorum, but we're going to get started. Representative Lesh is on the committee, and he's going to start presenting his bill. We can't really have a motion yet until we get a quorum. So, Representative Lesh, please go ahead and start with your testimony on House File 2385. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill should be relatively controversial because I have here Joe Carlson, who has been working with the defense bar on this. We are going to make a three-word oral amendment to modify the bill for the defense bar.
When we have a quorum.
And when we have a quorum, we will make that motion, but for explanation purposes, if Mr. Carlson could state what it is. For demonstrative purposes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. If members that look at the bill on lines 2.21 and 2.31, there are three words against the defendant that could give some confusion about when the 180 days would commence for starting the discovery. Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association asked us to remove those three words in those two places so that there would be no confusion. The statute would be clear. We support that. The Senate made this conforming change when it was heard in the Senate, and with that slight word change, Madam Chair, there's no opposition to the bill, and we'd appreciate your support.
If staff could make it clear to the members where it is that, those changes would be made.
Madam Chair, members, can I just ask, was it 2.2 and 2.31?
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, the amendment is to House File 2385 on line 2.2, strike against the defendant, and on 2.31, strike against the defendant.
All right, members, we actually now have a quorum, so I'll officially call the meeting to order. Representative Lesh has House File 2385, and the motion will be that this bill goes to the General Register. This bill will go to the General Register, but Representative Lesh has an oral amendment to get the bill in the shape that he would like it. That is the oral amendment that the staff just made clear. Is there questions from members based on that being an oral amendment? It didn't, of course, make the 24-hour rule, but if it's what makes this not controversial, I think we should allow it. Questions from members? All right. Representative Lesh moves the oral amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Lesh, to your bill.
Madam Chair, if I may, I think I'll let Joe Carlson speak.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I've had a chance to talk to many of you about this. This merely will update a statutory change to the updated rules of civil procedure that the court adopted in July of 2013. I don't believe there's any opposition to it. It just makes certain that the legislative mandate of 180 days of discovery is available, and we'd appreciate your support and happy to answer any questions.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. Representative Lesh renews his motion that House File 2385 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lesh. He's right there. Representative Rosenthal, the next two bills are yours. Why don't you come to the table and let us know which bill you'd like to take up first.
2131.
All right. Representative Rosenthal, I will move that House File 2241 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Rosenthal, it's my understanding that you have an A2 amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Members, I would move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like it. Questions from members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If the author could just explain what the amendment does, that would be helpful.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. As we first introduced this bill, we did it without a timeline, and this puts it to 72 hours.
Questions for members? All those in favor of getting the bill in the shape the author would like it, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a bill that I carried in 2009 having to do with domestic assault and warrantless arrest times. Originally in statute it was 12 hours, but police were finding it hard to, you know, with shift changes and people moving around, they just need a little bit more time to try and find these people. Over the last number of years, people have caught on to the 24-hour rule, and they're now hiding for longer. And with talks with Representative Cornish and others, we've come up with a 72-hour waiting period for a warrantless arrest on domestic assault. And, Madam Chair, I think we've been working really hard to come to the right number, and we think this is it. And with that, I'll turn it over to Rebecca Moses.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rebecca Moses, and I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. I'd like to tell you where this bill came from. We had 38 domestic violence homicides last year, and the idea for the bill came directly from law enforcement as one change that would immediately improve their ability to be effective. Last summer and fall, the bill was vetted by over 100 criminal justice, advocacy professionals, and community members at several domestic violence homicide convenings. I'd like to discuss the challenges with current statute as it has to do with gone on arrivals. Gone on arrival is the term used to describe situations where the perpetrator flees before law enforcement arrives. Under current statute, law enforcement can make probable cause warrantless arrests in most gone on arrival domestic violence situations without a time limit. They can do so for felony domestic violence type offenses, and they can also do so for non-felony violations of restraining orders. However, current law does not allow law enforcement to make a probable cause warrantless arrest after 24 hours for gone on arrival, misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor domestic abuse offenses. We know that there is heightened danger directly after assaults. Actually, in cases where there has been law enforcement intervention, yet there has been no perpetrator accountability, we know there's increased danger. Perpetrator accountability in many cases means law enforcement's ability to arrest and put conditions of release on a perpetrator. Accountability is directly tied to victim safety. If a victim of domestic abuse reaches out to law enforcement for help and the perpetrator cannot be arrested, over time, that victim's trust in the criminal justice system may erode and her very life may be in danger. Let me illustrate this problem with the gone on arrivals pose with the case of Gloria. The first time Gloria's partner abused her, she called the police, but he escaped before the police could arrive. He was purposefully evading law enforcement because he knew the police only had 24 hours to make a warrantless arrest. Then, 24 hours later, he would return and abuse her again. This happened several times in 1 week, and he always escaped before the officers arrived. Eventually, Gloria and her son had to flee their home to a domestic violence shelter because law enforcement did not have sufficient time to apprehend and arrest her abuser while they were seeking a warrant. This change in law would help women in Gloria's situation, and I'd like to turn it over to Chief Paul Schnell to address law enforcement's perspective of the situation.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Schnell, and I'm the Chief of Police for the Maplewood Police Department, and I'm here today testifying also on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. To improve victim safety and effectively hold perpetrators of domestic assault accountable, law enforcement needs sufficient time to apprehend and arrest these perpetrators when they flee the scene from these incidents. The current challenge is that when law enforcement has probable cause to believe that a misdemeanor domestic abuse has occurred, we're not always able to make a warrantless arrest within the current time frame, as was pointed out. The problem in such cases is that oftentimes that 24 hours is simply not enough time for law enforcement to either locate and or arrest or have that case submitted for purposes of obtaining an arrest warrant of the abuser before the abuser strikes again. This is a concern in both greater Minnesota and the metro area alike. Across our state, when a misdemeanor domestic assault offense occurs on or near weekends, 24 hours is simply not enough time to provide law enforcement to locate that perpetrator. Take, for instance, a case where a perpetrator, a domestic assault occurs at 8 p.m. on a Friday night. and the suspect flees the scene before law enforcement arrives. Even while probable cause was established at the time of the response on Friday night, if that same abuser returns on Friday to the victim's home at 11 p.m. on Saturday, the batterer cannot be arrested for the underlying offense. Obviously, this lack of ability to act reduces victim safety and undermines confidence in the current criminal justice system. And in some greater Minnesota communities, the current time limitations combined with lower levels of staffing and longer travel distances create even more significant challenges. In the metro area, where case volumes are often higher and with the present realities of law enforcement, 24 hours may not be enough to have that case submitted for purposes of obtaining a warrant. Under the law, violations of protection orders and felony domestic violence offenses are not subject to the time limit for warrantless arrest. Misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor abuse cases are equally serious crimes. In fact, as was pointed out, I believe, at one point in time by the chair, that these offenses can often be the same course of criminal conduct. The only difference is that the perpetrator has committed or has been convicted of that offense multiple times before. Extending the time period to 72 hours shows Minnesota's commitment to the seriousness of domestic abuse and the real danger that these offenders pose to the victims in the days after an assault has occurred. House File 2141 would provide a remedy to the problem identified in the case as described by the previous witness, the problem Gloria faced. This can be done by extending the time period for a probable cause warrantless arrest to 72 hours so that law enforcement has sufficient time to make warrantless arrests in cases where warrants cannot be obtained within that period of time. I would thank you for your consideration of this bill, and I can stand for any questions you may have.
Questions from members? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schnell, this body has put a lot of resources over the last half decade into the Praxis audit and the blueprint to safety, which enabled prosecutors to charge these cases immediately, thereby creating probable cause and allowing for arrests. Would this change obviate all those changes that we made previously, the whole point of which was to get these gone on arrival, a big part of that blueprint was making sure that these gone on arrivals get charged quickly, and therefore they're individually reviewed by an attorney. So I think now, once upon a time, there was all these gone on arrivals that came through, and they went to the bottom of the pile, right? Because we're not going to catch these creepers, and you know, and then there's a section of them that were pretty bad. But in the cases that I review, there was also a section of them that were, they were flatly non-chargeable. You just couldn't do anything with them, and some of them were even innocuous. But what of all the changes we made under the blueprint and Bridges to Safety in St. Paul? Is that no longer necessary with this change?
Chief Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I do believe that all of the changes that have been put in place and the research that I think was actually cited, we know that one of the things that makes a difference relative to these cases is sure and swift response. And certainly all the efforts that have been put into the research that came out of Praxis and Blueprint and all of the strategies that can be put into place for making sure those cases are quickly reviewed by prosecutors are critically important, I think, to victim safety and community safety. At the same time, I think where we see really unique challenges around these cases are some of those really rare, quite common instances where we simply don't have access to prosecutors. With the Friday night example, until Monday, we could call somebody in, but as a practice, as you know, it just is not it's not readily available. And I think given the fact that we may know as a result of our of the lethality assessments that are being done in many of these cases that these offenders do represent high risk, but because of the nature of what was said, what was communicated, weapon access, but we simply can't act because in that period of time, we don't necessarily have access to that prosecutor for review of that case and issuance of a complaint and warrant.
Thank you.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to either the testifiers or the author. Just so I understand correctly, so it's a warrantless arrest for a misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor violation of a harassment restraining order or OFP?
Would like to answer that. Chief Schnell.
Representative Moline, actually under current statute, if you violate an order for protection, harassment restraining order, or DANCO or other protection or restraining order, there is no time limit. We're not changing that. We're just applying this to misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor domestic abuse. So, for instance, if you have a violation of an order for protection that equals a misdemeanor, there is no time limit on those cases.
Follow up. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I guess my question is, to establish a harassment restraining order, I believe the burden of proof is only preponderance of the evidence, and to establish an order for protection, I think it's clear and convincing evidence. So, you know, they're not criminal convictions. They have much lower threshold as far as proving whether or not that should take place. And I know in the harassment restraining order, specifically, most of those are issued ex parte, temporary ex parte orders, and then people have a option to request a hearing in order to challenge the harassment restraining order. And I'm wondering if you're in that window where it's an ex parte order, temporary ex parte harassment restraining order, would this apply under those circumstances?
Ms. Moses.
Madam Chair, Representative Moline, I hear your concerns. We're not actually making any changes to statute around the violations of order for protection, HRO. So that is current statute. I think it depends on the fact pattern, exactly how that would play out. We're dealing with misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor domestic abuse, which covers domestic assault, interference with 911 calls, and those specific crimes. So we're not making any changes except for clarifying what is meant by protection orders and restraining orders.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it's a alleged domestic abuse that would violate a harassment restraining order or OFP that's in place.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rosenthal.
Representative Moline, this would be a new charge. It's not.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So we're not.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Yeah, no, I understand that. I just, my concerns are with the low threshold to establish an harassment restraining order in the first place, and being that most of those orders are issued ex parte where a person hasn't even had a chance to be heard yet. You know, I just wonder if we should lower the threshold for what the consequences could be in violating an ex parte order.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rosenthal.
Representative Moline, the history of this bill, I first carried it in 2009. It was a 12-hour time limit. It was then raised to 24 hours. During that time, it's become clear that people who make these offenses are aware of the time limit and they're hiding. And working through with Representative Cornish and others, we're trying to get around the fact that weekends can be a real big problem. And 72 hours seem to be the number that would address that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none, I will move that House File 2241 be re-referred to the General Register as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
So, Representative Rosenthal, you have House File 1335.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Please go ahead, Representative Rosenthal.
There is an amendment, I believe.
So, members, I just want to let members know that This bill did not move forward in the Senate on a tie. I believe you have an amendment to take care of some of the issues that happened in the Senate. Is that correct? That makes it a little less?
We hope so.
Okay. And is that the A2 amendment?
That would be the A1 amendment.
That's
A3 amendment.
The A3 amendment. So is it your intention to offer the A3 amendment here? I mean, it didn't, it of course, we didn't know that that was going to happen in the Senate. Correct. So should I have the staff prepare the A3 amendment as well?
That would be entirely up to you, Madam Chair. As far as I'm concerned, the A2 amendment is sufficient for now. If we need to amend it on the floor or somewhere else, we can.
Okay. So why don't you go ahead and present, and we'll listen to the what folks think here. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if people have read the Star Tribune a couple days ago, but there's a big article on the Senate bill and what great things it did. This basically is sets provisions for hit-and-run driving or collisions, and it basically states that if you hit something, you got to stop in a reasonably safe place near to the scene and investigate what you hit, whether it be a tree, a cone, a person, or another car. This amendment has some technical aspects that I'll leave to my testifiers, because there are certain instances with the rollover that's not a collision, so we might have to put accident and collision back together. But the basis of the bill is to make people stop and be aware and accountable for what they hit, and not be able to say, well, I thought it was a brick in the road or whatever it was, when it could have been anything. It could have been a baby's carriage, could have been a tire of a car, who knows. But it's incumbent, and it's common sense, I think, that you would stop and just see what you would hit. And if you hit something that had damage or was a person, you came to their aid. And if you hit a car, you reported it and took responsibility for your actions.
Welcome.
So with that, go ahead, Mrs. Chair.
I was saying,
Madam Chair.
Do you want to have your testifiers then go next?
Yes, please.
All right. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair and committees, my name is Chris Zell. I'm from St. Louis Park. I live with my husband, 2 children, and I work as an accountant. First of all, I'd like to tell you how grateful I am to be here, and I'd like to thank you in advance for your thoughtful consideration of this proposed legislation. I'd like to thank Representative Rosenthal and Kelly and the many people who have helped put tireless hours in on this legislation. I'm here on behalf of my dad, my brother Kyle, and Kane's, my other brother Kane's widow, Mari. My brother Kane Thompson was 26 years old when he was struck and killed by a hit-and-run driver while he was legally changing a tire on the side of the road. As you can imagine, it was a day that changed our life forever. The driver who struck and killed Kane was charged and convicted with felony counts, including hit-and-run. From the very beginning, the charges and the convictions did absolutely nothing to help us. It did nothing to bring Kane back to us. However, after 7 or 8 years of appeals to the Minnesota Supreme Court and the ultimate reversal of the hit-and-run conviction, we could no longer sit back and watch. They said that the state failed to prove that he knew he hit a person or a vehicle. We find this hard to believe. He hit a 230-pound man. He drove over and drug a 5-inch thick tire from Kane's car with a flat tire of his own, a dent in his hood, and a broken-out headlight at 11:30 at night. The pure and simple fact is he did not stop to investigate what he struck. The Minnesota Supreme Court reversal has ultimately paved the way for drivers to claim ignorance as to what was hit. We've seen it used as a defense already in several cases. It's very difficult to prove what went on in a mind of someone at the time of collision. It also encourages drunk and other impaired drivers to flee the scene instead of offering life-saving assistance. This proposed legislation requires that a driver stop and determine what was struck. This change could help many people and quite possibly save lives. Every time I hear of another hit-and-run story on the news, I am first of all sick to my stomach thinking about the family and that family that's just been torn apart. And second, I'm appalled thinking that I'll probably soon be hearing it used as a defense in yet another case to possibly benefit someone else. It's incomprehensible to me that we allow this to continue. The time has come for this to be fixed. So please give this your thoughtful attention, pass it, and let's move forward holding people accountable for their actions. Thank you. I'd like to refer now to Kelly Moeller.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Kelly Moeller, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Alliance on Crime. I'm also an appellate prosecutor, and I handled one of the appeals that involved Kane Thompson, the Al-Nazir case that Chris mentioned. And the Supreme Court said in 2007 in that case that there may be a shortcoming with the current hit-and-run statute, and there might be a good reason why the legislature would want to require drivers involved in a collision to stop and determine what it is they struck. As I said, that happened in 2007, and here we are 7 years later wanting to change the statute, to change those shortcomings, to close the loopholes that drivers are using to avoid responsibility for hit and run and offer life-saving support for anybody that might be injured in a collision. Now, while the bill requires people to stop and investigate what it is they struck in a collision, they're only going to be criminally liable when they don't stop if they have, in fact, hit a person or another car. I also want to make it clear that we're not changing any of the other requirements that are currently in the statute regarding reporting and providing notice to police. And we aren't changing any of the criminal penalties as well. We do have support letters from the County Attorneys Association, the Sheriff's Association, Minnesotans for Safe Driving, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, the Bicyclers Association. Thank you.
Questions from members? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So with the changes, do I have to stop? If this bill passes, do I have to stop if a bird hits my windshield?
Who would like that? Are you Ms. Moeller?
Yep.
Ms. Moeller.
Yep, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh. So what we want is drivers to be aware of what it is they hit. If you're driving along and you see that you've hit, a deer, and you know it's a deer, you don't have to stop. But if you were fiddling with your radio or looking for your phone and you hit something and you didn't know what it is, then you will need to stop. So this bill creates the duty to stop and investigate, but you're not going to be criminally liable if you don't stop and it ended up being a bird or a squirrel or something like that.
Representative Lesh.
Well, and maybe thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Moeller, maybe you can help me out, but I don't see that in the language. I'm looking under the individual. So can you point me out where that is?
Ms. Moeller.
Yep, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh. So if you look at subdivision 1, that is the driver to stop for a collision and investigate what was struck. And then if the driver knows or has reason to know there's injury or death to a person, then they have to remain at the scene and follow the other requirements. That matches up with the penalties section in subdivision 14. And it also corresponds with the CVO and CVH statute, which references this subdivision.
Representative Lesh.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still a little bit confused because I don't see in the language where that obviates me from stopping if I know I hit a deer or a raccoon. But maybe we can. Where is this going to go, Madam Chair?
No one else has requested it, so the General Register is the next stop. Representative Paymar,
no,
is it going to you?
I'll ask here then. Thank you, Madam Chair. The general prohibition under Subdivision 1, and of course the titles, of course, under case law are not included in this statute. So we just have to look at the language. And the language as proposed would say the driver of any motor vehicle involved in a collision shall immediately stop the vehicle at the scene of the collision or as close to the scene as possible and reasonably investigate what was struck, period. So it doesn't seem to me that I would have an out for not stopping if I hit a raccoon. Am I wrong about that?
Ms. Moeller.
Yep, Madam Chair, Representative Lesh. Yes, if you look at the penalties in subdivision 14, that's where the criminal liability is. And so what you're reading with subdivision 1, it continues on to say that if the driver knows or has reason to know there's injury or death, they remain. But if you look at the penalties in subdivision 14, those are all the penalties involving injury or death.
Okay, so
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, so Ms. Moeller, so you're saying because there is no express penalty in the
penalties section for the scenario I described, it's your contention then that that act, my act of not stopping for the raccoon, the dead raccoon, would not be illegal. Is that correct?
Ms. Mueller.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, that's correct. That, along with the additional language that's in Subdivision 1.
Okay, and Lesh. Madam Chair and Ms. Mueller, it's my understanding that any general prohibition contained in the Criminal Code 609 for which there is not an express penalty is by default a misdemeanor. Is that your understanding as well?
Ms. Mueller.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, that I don't know, but like I said, the additional language in Subdivision 1 gives the other requirements for the driver. So you're not guilty of that unless you also, after you stop, know or have reason to know there's injury or death.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I don't have any other questions. I know that they worked hard on this, and I may be over-wordsmithing it, but I just want to make sure there's not a loophole for that. No other questions, Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenthal, would you just tell me what the amendment does? You don't have to go through each step of it, but I can't seem to follow it all. And then that first question is, secondly, did you request a fiscal note for the bill?
Who would like the question?
Or do we have a, Representative Waltz have a, I don't know if he already has it.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Representative Paymar, to your second question, we have not requested a fiscal note. And to your first question, I'll let Ms. Mueller answer.
Ms. Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Paymar. So what the A2 amendment does is the bill itself actually covers, the current statute actually covers two different things. It's got the hit and run provisions, and then the other part of the statute has to do with accident reporting requirements to the Department of Public Safety for all accidents, not just hit and run. And so when we initially drafted this bill and we changed the language to collision, we didn't realize we were changing all of the Department of Public Safety's reporting requirements in addition to the hit and run provision. So what we've done then is, for those provisions related specifically to the Department of Public Safety, we've left that language as accident and just changed it to collision with respect to the hit-and-run portions of the bill.
Thank you. And
then Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, so Mr. Waltz.
Mr. Waltz.
I don't know how many cases this would involve, but there's felony provisions. I don't know if there's gross misdemeanor here, but there's a number of felonies under penalties. How soon could we get?
Mr. Walsh.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, in my initial going through the bill, I misunderstood its implications and assumed that there would not be a cost. It is possible that sentencing guidelines could determine this would increase sentences to prison. If they find that there's a material change in the number of people that could be sentenced to prison, corrections could put a fiscal note on this bill, and one will be requested after this hearing.
Very good. Thank you.
Representative Paymar, do you want this sent to you?
Well, if there's a fiscal impact, I think it should, but I've got a full plate. Yeah, otherwise it's going to the
General Register.
Then it should probably go to...
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, it's my understanding that we're not changing any fines or definitions of...
Ms. Mueller.
Yep. Madam Chair and Representative Paymar, when we initially discussed this bill, we did not feel like there would be any fiscal impact here because we're not changing any of the penalties at all. And we're just eliminating that I didn't know I hit something defense. We actually think it could save money and some of the litigation costs that are involved when those defenses are raised. But I don't know, it's going to end up with more people in prison as a result of these changes.
Representative Paymar.
I'll leave it to Mr. Waltz to provide some advice to the committee.
Representative Paymar, one of the options we could do is we could either send it to you, and if you don't need to hear it, you can waive it.
Let's do that. That makes sense.
All right. Questions from members? Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenthal. I was just going through some things, and I found a could be a possible fatal flaw in the bill. If a person is standing on the edge of the road and they're hit by a car, that would not be a collision. Because unfortunately, by the definition of a collision, it has to be two or more moving objects. So if a person was not moving or fell asleep in the middle of the road, it wouldn't qualify under this bill, because the definition you're using, it has to be two or more moving objects for the definition of collision.
Ms. Muller.
That's one reason why law enforcement, they quit using the word accident. We call them crashes, because usually an accident is avoidable. An accident is unavoidable, a crash is not. But with the term collision, requires two or more moving objects by the definition of the word itself.
Ms. Muller.
Yep. Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, we went round and round about the terms we were going to use here, and we specifically decided with collision and not to define it. And actually, we looked at various dictionary definitions of collision, and one was the act of colliding or coming together with sudden or violent force. So it didn't necessarily require two moving objects. It could be the motor vehicle with something else. And part of the reason why we went with collision as opposed to crash was that we wanted to avoid those situations where someone said, I didn't know I had a crash. I thought I sideswiped a barrel or a mailbox. Crash and accident both seem to imply the idea of your car coming to a halt and more things happening. And I do understand that crash is the preferred term among law enforcement, but we wanted to be specific in this case with the word collision because we thought it encompassed more situations that we could encounter with this bill.
Representative Johnson.
I can understand that, but if you're going to use that word, you should probably get it in the definition so it's more specific, because when I Googled it, the first three definitions that I ran across, the word for collision requires two or more moving objects, and that's and collision is not, the word collision is not defined in statute.
Ms. Muller.
Yep, Madam Chair and Representative, we did, every time we tried to come up with a definition, it was difficult, and it got to be very wordy and cumbersome, and so we felt more comfortable with, in discussion with the County Attorneys Association too, leaving that term open, and then judges will instruct juries to use their own common sense definitions of the terms.
Other questions from members? Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, is there a time limit? I mean, if where I drive, every once in a while a raccoon gets under my tire. And, does it have to happen simultaneously? Or if you're down the road, 30 minutes or 30 seconds from where you thought you hit something and there's something else that happens, are you then somehow liable to this?
Ms. Muller.
Madam Chair and Representative, the statute says you must stop at the scene or as close as possible. As close as the scene as possible. So if you can't stop for some reason, then that's fine. You could wait until you can safely stop, go to the next exit. There's also the requirement under Subdivision 6 that you can call law enforcement as well. But if you can't stop at the scene, that's fine. We don't want people to put their life at risk to stop either.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions from members? All right. So, Representative Rosenthal, I will move that House File 1335 be referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Finance, but I want to adopt the amendment, and then we're going to ask if there's any public testimony. So the chair moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Representative Rosenthal, are you completed with your testimony? Because then I'm going to ask for public testimony.
I am, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come forward, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is Michael Harrison. I'm a registered lobbyist. I have some concerns with the bill. mainly the fact that it takes away my defense. I, from the testimony I heard, and I didn't quite see it in the bill, but it took away my defense that, hey, I didn't know what I hit, and I went on. And it kind of had two situations where, one, I hit a raccoon in my wife's small car, which put a dent in the floorboard. So I know that, you know, there was some damage. We seen the raccoon go off into the woods and whatever happened there. And there was also another time when a gentleman was walking his dog, and his dog stepped out in front of me as I was passing by. And I was in a pickup truck, about a three-quarter ton pickup truck, loaded with construction tools. And basically, all I heard was like a thump thump, like I was crossing over Robinson Road or whatever. I knew I hit the dog, and I stopped. And my concern is that I go to court or come later to find out that I hit something, and it happened to be a human being that I didn't know. And of course, we brought up the bird and everything else. You know, maybe I thought I hit a bird. And my concern is I don't have that defense now, because what I heard early in testimony, that would not allow me to use that as a defense. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, questions from members? Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if Representative Rosenthal can bring us up to speed on what the concerns were with the line 7.17 and 7.18 of the bill in the Senate. Can you review what the concerns were there?
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Draskowski, could you repeat the line numbers, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. 7.17 and 7.18,
Representative. Representative Rosenthal.
Madam Chair, Representative Draskowski, I'm not opposed to this amendment. It does dilute the bill quite a bit. And, you know, people are using for defense that they didn't know what they hit. So this does take a big bite out of the bill. I'm willing to put it on if necessary. But at this time, I prefer not to.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So can you characterize what the opposition was there that pulled it out in the Senate?
Representative Rosenthal.
Or maybe her name again. Ms. Mueller.
It's my understanding that it hasn't happened yet, that currently the bill is sitting in committee. Is that correct? That it hasn't been amended, but that this is one of the proposals to amend the bill to make it out, because the bill is stuck there on a tie, if that's an accurate representation. Ms. Mueller.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative, that is an accurate representation, and we spoke with one of the no voters yesterday, and his concern with this provision was he felt like the legislature would be then telling the courts what defenses weren't acceptable, and that it was overstepping. However, I did explain that in the criminal sexual conduct context, we do say mistake as to age is not a defense, and that's been upheld by the courts. But I told him that if it would mean that he would change his no vote to a yes vote, if he'd be willing to move to reconsider it, that's why we agreed to take that language out in the Senate.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Mueller.
Further questions from members? All right. With that, the chair renews the motion that House File 1335, as amended, be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
We need to motion to approve the minutes of March 11th. Who moved them? Representative Hortman moves the minutes. Any errors or corrections? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. With that, this meeting's adjourned.
Thank you.